I'm going to talk about the Moira machine experiments, the big project. It's a project that started in 2016. And we also talk about some follow-up projects as well, hopefully if time allows. Please do feel free to interrupt me if you have any, especially if you have clarifying questions that will help you to understand what's going after. And if you want to have more critical questions, that's also always welcome. Or if you want to keep it to the end, that's also, I'll try to make sure that there is enough time at the end for questions. All right. So as probably you all know now, our driverless cars are already being tested on the roads in different places in the world, and they still have a lot of technical issues, of course. But let's say in the future, once they tackle all of these technical and social issues, maybe they will become a reality, right? And some people have made some calculations saying that once they have been perfected in terms of safety, they will be able to minimize 90% of the current crashes by humans. Now, regardless whether this number is accurate or miscalculated, but let's say it is 90%, and there are still remaining 10%. And some of these 10% might include cases where the cars are basically resolving moral trade-offs. Now, a very stylized, abstracted version of this moral trade-offs is inspired by most people here know as the trolley problem, but in the domain of driverless cars, this is the simplest version of it. The car is on the road, 10 pedestrians jump in front of it, brake fails, the car is about to kill them. The only way out is if it swerves into this passerby and sacrifice the passerby. Should the car do that, or should it just continue to kill the 10 people? In another version, the car swerves into a barrier, sacrificing its own passenger. And should the car do that? Of course, this was basically a study where initially was published in 2016 by my co-authors and my former advisor. And they found that most people actually approve of utilitarian driverless cars. They think it is fine for cars to sacrifice their own passengers to save 10 pedestrians. But there was a catch, of course, because when they asked people if they're willing to buy such a self-sacrificing cars, people say they're not willing to do that. Now, many people have, of course, we've presented this work for a while, and a lot of people have said, look, driverless cars will never face these trolley problem dilemmas, which is could be true, could be maybe they're going to be very rare situations. But, driverless cars will probably face moral trade-offs. And we actually do face moral trade-offs in our daily lives, and we resolve them on a daily basis. Let's take this this case, which is less stylized than before. Imagine you're driving the car in the middle, the white car in the middle, and you have this big truck on your right. This is a cyclist on your left. Now, maybe you might be inclined to drive closer to the cyclist because maybe you're conscious about this big truck and you're trying to protect yourself. In this case, you are pushing more risk towards this cyclist. Or maybe you're very conscious about the cyclist, so you drive closer to the car and shifting more risk towards yourself, right? Now, while doing these things, maybe if I have asked you in a survey online, you will all say, well, of course, I'm going to go closer to the big truck because I'm such a nice person. I'm an altruist. I would, sacrifice myself to help everyone else. But then in reality, you would do something different, right? Now, let's take you out of this and now put a driverless car instead, right? With driverless cars, you will be implementing these decisions ahead of time, right? And actually, you probably would not be specifically saying in this scenario, I will do this or will do that. But basically, the car would make calculations based on a lot of data and some optimization and whatever. And maybe these techniques will become as a side effect of the car minimizing the company's liability or maximizing user inconvenience, right? But in a way or another, imagine now you have this driverless cars who have all of this implemented ahead of time. So you don't really have to, there's no spur of the moment decisions. And also these decisions are implemented in hundreds of thousands of cars because the same algorithm is doing the same thing. Now imagine you have two companies. One of them, the cars goes closer to the site, to the big truck in this case, the other one goes closer to the cyclist. And let's say after driving hundreds of thousands of miles or millions of miles, let's say the one that is driving closer to the truck maybe this risk materializes in the death of 5 people, while for the other one, the risk materializes in sacrificing one cyclist. Then we kind of get back into the trolley problem, but at the statistical level, right? So in a way, this is not really, this whole discussion is not really about the trolley dilemma, the trolley problem, and what the car will do when it's going to be, killing actually actively, right? It's more about how these machines will actually change the distribution of risk in this new world, right? And it kind of mirrors also all the other concerns about AI in general, that how would the AI change the distribution of different values, distribution of wealth, distribution of, the fairness, all of these things, that are increasing inequality. How would machines change that calculations, right? Okay, so I hope that's kind of clear, at least. So we wanted to understand what regular people think about this, right? Especially that it is important because the emotional salience of people when there's always crash in the news, it's always like quite big. So we built this website called More Machine, the website was deployed in 2016. Basically, it generates random moral dilemmas that are faced by driverless car. In this case, for example, the car has one passenger and it's headed on the road, and these 4 pedestrians jump in front of it, brake fails, like in every story, the car is about to kill them, and the only way out is it swerves into this barrier, which means it will sacrifice this female athlete inside the car, but if it does not, it will kill these 4 pedestrians who are, by the way, all jaywalking, including the dog. What should the car do? And then you will basically, as a user of the website, you would say, oh, I think the car should do this or do that. And then you click, and then you get the next scenario. You get 13 of these scenarios, and at the end, just as a gamification value, we tell people, give you back, saying some summary of like, okay, so this is how you answered your questions. You know, this is how you compare to other people who have answered this. Now, these are not very scientific, but at least, you know, the people engaged, they basically encourage them to be more truthful about what they would do. In building this website, we kind of try to include multiple different characters in this website. This has 2 values. One of them is, well, it gives more engagement, but it's also increased the external validity of our findings. And we will see that later on, that, you know, this, whatever we're trying to see, like whether it's like we're trying to study gender or age, like it's not studied by specific kind of characters, but by different kind of characters. So you see here, like, you know, adult and kids and seniors, and you see like athletes and a criminal and a baby and a dog and a cat. And then in building this scene, we kind of created 4 different components. One of them is whether the car should stay or swerve, just to represent omission versus commission. Also the relationship of those potential casualties with the car. So they could be either pedestrians or passenger. And if they are pedestrians, whether they're crossing legally or illegally, and also some features about those, let's say, passengers or pedestrians. In this case, we're putting one group as being older than the other group. Okay. So basically, we have multiple factors, and this is basically a multifactorial design where we include multiple attributes and we vary them on top of each other with some restrictions. And then we try to understand the effect of each of these attributes on people's answer. So the first one, as I mentioned, was interventionism. And then we have this, which you also mentioned, and legality, and then all of these factors. Now, these factors, we chose them because we knew from the literature that they do make a difference on people's decisions, on the regular people, not because we think that they should. So we took these factors together, and then we put this website up, and then we just, we translated the website to 10 languages. What happened that suddenly the website was, to our surprise, got a lot of attention. So we realized we want to, from different places in the world, so we wanted to make sure we also reach, try to reach more audience and reach more representative samples. Very painful task, you know, translating a website. Don't try it. 4 million users came to the website during the first 18 months, They contributed to 40 million decisions during those 18 months. And there was a optional survey at the end. So we had like almost like a 500,000 people who filled this survey, which has also demographics. Now, of course, the website is still running, so we're still collecting data, and this 40 million has become, I think, 100 million. So we're not doing anything with the data yet, but potentially later on. This is basically a map showing a one dot for one location from each one user, at least one person came. Of course, it is representative in some places, but like in other places, like in Africa, we don't have a lot of people. Just for comparison, you can see here on the map of the where there is light or electricity. So you can see that places where they have access to electricity, somehow the website somehow reached someone there. And the results of this, all of this, were basically published in this the Nature journal paper, and which I'm going to tell you now about the results right now. All right. So in order to understand the results, the x-axis is basically a difference between two probabilities, and these are the probability of choosing the right-hand side minus probability of choosing the left-hand side. So in this case, I'm going to take all the scenarios that have humans on one of the sides, and I'm going to see how often people choose to save them, and I'll call that probability of sparing the humans. And then I'll do the same thing with pets, and then I'll subtract these two probabilities, and then I'll get this number, which is 0.6. Then you could do the same thing with number of lives, okay? So again, you could do the same thing. You take all the scenarios that have one, that have two, three, four. And in this case, one here means you added one more character. Four means you've added four more. So this is a case of moving from one to five. And as you can see here, as you know, as you add more lives, the preferences increases. And the average of that somehow coincides with two. You could do the same for all of the other factors, and you could also compare the different factors. So as you can see, we talked about sparing humans over pets seem to be the most consistent, let's say, preferences come after sparing more lives over fewer, which is sparing utilitarianism, and then sparing the young over the elderly, which also some people would say another form of utilitarianism. And then after these three, which are quite stronger than the others, come these two others, which is paying the lawful over the unlawful, and higher status over lower status, and then up to preference for inaction over action, which is the omission versus commission. All right, so we have these nine different numbers, which we can see at the global level. Now, sparing the young over the elderly was quite a curious thing, because it's probably among these three, it's probably the most controversial, even though that perhaps many of you probably know that in the medical domain, there are situations where it is justified to use age as a factor in prioritization. But at the same time, we were curious to know like whether this is something influenced by some specific characters. So we could actually do the same analysis at the level of each of our characters. Remember, we had 20 different characters. So similarly, the x-axis here, I'm going to take all the scenarios that have a baby stroller, one baby stroller in it, and I'll see how often people spare them. And then I will do the same thing with the adult male and adult female, right? And I get another probability. And I'll subtract these two probabilities, and I will get this x-axis, and we see baby stroller is much more preferred to be spared than the adult male and female. And then you do the same thing for all of the other characters. And then you can see that some of them are on the positive side, which means they are spared more than the adults, the adult male and female, and others on the negative side, which means they are low. Now, if you look at the top four, you can see that they all involve young characters. So it seems like, and this is kind of the preference for age, is somehow something that's quite consistent. We can see it across the different characters. Now, also at the same thing as well, if you look at the bottom, I mean, you can see the dog and the cat and the criminal that comes in between, curiously. After that, you can see that also elderly comes also back. So it seems like, people do feel very strongly about the age as a factor, to have a preference over. As I mentioned, people came from different places in the world. So we could basically do the same analysis at the level of each country. We had people like coming from over 200 countries, but for this analysis, we took the countries that we had at least 100 participants from, and basically we calculated the same nine numbers for each country. And then we can calculate, so you have a vector of nine dimension, a vector, and then you could calculate the distance between every two countries. And then you could use that to do like using a hierarchical clustering, which can be visualized in this dendrogram. It shows multiple levels. So you could see for each country, what is the closest country to their answers. But also you can see broadly how countries congregate, right? So you can see, I don't know if you can see the colors, but basically you have three colors of branches. There's the red one, Western, we called it, and then the blue one, the Eastern, and then the yellow one, which is called the Eastern. And then the color of the country names, they're colored using some cultural map that Engelhard, Belzel, two anthropologists have came up with. So it's not our own, but some of these names might seem like a bit of weird classification, that some countries are, you know, English speaking, others are Confucian or Catholic majority or Baltic or whatever. So here you can see that these countries, for example, like Latin American countries, are all in one.
But the Isle of Man has come out like Myanmar. That's bizarre. So it won't always be exactly right.
Yeah. So it's not. It's not
perfect. Something odd. Yeah. It must be a small. Must be a small sample issue.
That's true. That's true.
That's very, very unlikely. Unless. So these, why they have these hierarchical clustering things, is it are places which are near on the circle actually near to each other, or yes, are they just near in the? But the tree, if you look at UK and Australia, that little,
sorry, I didn't see that.
That root there has branched off right up there. It's very near the root of the tree.
Yes, true. So like,
so that's very important.
Yes, that's true. So, I mean, of course, this method is a little bit sensitive to some changes, but I guess, and we could do statistical tests to show that it's better than random, at least. But you know, you could for visual validity, you could see, for example, that these countries that are, you know, English speaking, they kind of congregate together. And I'll talk about these three clusters now. So the first one, as I said, we call it Western because it has many Western countries. Of course, with some exceptions. You can see English-speaking countries. You can see the Protestant, Catholic, and Orthodox countries. The second one, which we call Eastern, has Islamic countries, Confucian, and South Asian countries. And then the last one was a bit of a weird one. We called it Southern, but it basically have two subclusters. One of them has quite clearly Latin American, with some exception there. And clear, like some kind of apparently former French colonies, somehow, you know, appearing together in this. Now, what you could do next, is try to see how each cluster is different from the other two. So this is now just really doing comparisons between the clusters. One note to keep here is that for all of these nine differences that I showed you, the direction is always, or most of the time, is the same across countries, but the magnitude is different. So in this case, we're calculating, this is the z-score, so z equals zero means average. Western doesn't have much interesting stuff because it has most countries, so it's closer to average and everything. But you can see here, for example, that in the Eastern society or like Eastern cultures, you can see that, for example, sparing the lawful is a little bit stronger than average, sparing pedestrians a little bit stronger. Sparing the younger is very weak, right? And they do still spare the younger over the elderly, but at the same time, this difference is much less pronounced in those countries, which is kind of also consistent with anthropological studies that they have more spirituality, they have more respect to the elderly, they have stronger family ties. And then the southern one have also some kind of sparing females is much stronger, for example, which is apparently something driven by France and all the countries that were influenced by them, which is, you know, stronger than in other European countries, for example. Much more probably insightful is trying to get at exploring some of the, let's say, association, and these are association at the country level. One of the let's say anthropological or cultural measures is individualism, that some countries are very individualistic. People focus on the individuals. They see themselves as independent, Those countries usually have strong institutions, while on the other extreme, we have collectivist countries where people have a stronger family ties. They have their loyalty is to their extended families rather than to the state. So in individualist countries, they usually like more like egalitarian. So everyone is equal, everyone is the same. And so having more, saving more lives is always better than saving fewer lives, while in the collectivist society, there are other factors that might play in. Another also factor or index is called rule of law, which is how much respected the law in a country as well. You can see here that sparing the lawful is correlated with it. As well, countries like Japan or Germany have a very strong rule of law. And in these countries, it seems like, sparing the lawful was always preferred in most countries, but this difference becomes bigger in those ones. I'm going to talk now about the implication of what I just mentioned. I just want to make sure that also make it clear that, many of you, of course, know that there's a distinction between normative ethics and descriptive ethics. And this work that I presented is more about descriptive ethics. Normative ethics is what, what we should do. Descriptive ethics is what, the general public think we should do, or what we actually do, what our culture tells us to do, norms tell us to do. So this was more like, descriptive, trying to get at what people usually or think they, regular people would do. But there have been some efforts on at normative ethics, a lot of efforts, but usually, I think at the level of countries, Germany was the first country that actually, they brought in a committee and they brought this committee representatives from different domains in law, ethics, engineering, and Catholic bishop as well. So this committee, they sat together for a few months and eventually they came up with some set of rules. Of course, there's, from hearing from one of the members of the committee, they said there was a lot of fighting, of course, and people, there were things where people did not want to sign their names off until they were being resolved. So at the end of it, there were some contradicting statements because everyone wanted to be, represented in the statements. What I'm going to do is just now, I'll just list the top five preferences that we found in people, and I will just make a, connection to what the committee have actually said. The first thing, as I said, is human over pets. There was a line in that report that said it's fine if we give priority for humans over, pets or objects, if that's the only way out to save a human. The second factor is more over fewer. This is where the committee were a little bit conflicted because some people said, it's fine if you do programming to reduce the number of lives lost, but there was another sentence that they also add saying, but you should not be comparing lives and sacrificing lives for other lives. So in a way, just to appease both parts of the or different parts of the committee. Young over elderly, this was previously in complete disagreement with the committee, who said this is unacceptable and discrimination over age is wrong. Lawful over unlawful, in a way, not completely in disagreement because they had some statements saying, well, if the whole dilemma came about because somebody was not following the law, then the people who are following the law should not pay the price. Now, notice how this is sentence is being put in a way. So does that mean the car should punish the people who jaywalks? That does sound a bit harsh. So no, we don't say that, but, so kind of in a way, again, it's not very controversial, but in a way you could think about it that not completely in disagreement. And of course, this last one is clearly in disagreement. Now to come to the second part of the implication, I mentioned about the level of the countries, and we found that, for example, some countries are more in favor of sacrificing the jaywalkers than others. So let's say we have, for example, some driverless cars in some country, and they have some level of harm. It's not 100%. It's probably better than regular cars, so that's why it's enough to have them on the road. And let's say somebody came up with some update, and this update will result in better or more safer driverless cars. But this safety is conditional on the fact that everyone is crossing legally, right? In fact, those who are crossing illegally, things would be even worse for them. Then should this company basically implement this update? And in a way, that seems like in countries like Germany and Japan, it seems like that is the moral thing to do, the right thing to do for people. Like, you know, of course, you know, we should be able to have those cars on the road. But in other countries, but maybe like in the Middle East, where I am from, or in Latin America, people would find it like outrageous that you will basically implement cars that could be more harmful for, you know, it's like, you know, outrageously harsh punishment. So this was the results of the Nature paper that I just mentioned, but there have been some work, follow-up work on the motor machine data. One of them is basically this collaboration with Josh Tenenbaum's group at MIT, who do like work on cognitive science and computational cognitive science. And this is basically proof of concept, building a computational model using hierarchical Bayesian modeling. In this case, we can assume that people have latent preferences over the different characters, right? And then we will try to see that based on these latent preferences, which we don't know, they have answered the Moore machine questions, right? So what we're going to do is we'll try to reverse engineer how they've done that, right? So we're going to take their answers and basically we'll take the scenario and split it basically the characters into this, let's say vector, which will tell you one, if the character exists in your scenario, and then you reduce the dimensionality of those group using some concept, like for example, you know, the pregnant woman and the baby, they are both like good babies. So it's kind of a conceptually, they're the same. And then from those answers, you basically try to calculate the, basically, you know, you could think about the utility is a combination of both the weight of each of these factors and whether they exist or not. Now the weight, we don't know, which is what we try to uncover or reverse engineer using people's answer. Once you uncover the weights for each person, then you would be able to calculate, if I give you a new dilemma, then you can multiply the weight by whether these persons exist. And then you can tell me, oh, this person, they would, for them, the utility of saving this group would be better than this group. And you know, as a result, you can predict what they would have done. Another project was with people at CMU, who was basically using a collective decision maker. Again, this is also a proof of concept, so we don't really recommend doing it. But let's say if you have a group of people who have answered some of these scenarios, then you can basically model what they would have answered on all of the other possible scenarios. And then somehow you can have some kind of a collective decision maker or an aggregation function that could aggregate all of this together. And now it gives you one big function that would tell you what the whole society would have answered in this situation. Now, again, this is probably not a good idea because, you know, people are misinformed and biased and whatever, right? But maybe let's say if you take a subset of those scenarios, some of these scenarios that maybe that the experts think are defensible or acceptable, but the experts disagree over, then maybe the, you know, the public could be used as a tie-breaking rules, for example. Okay, so now let's forget about driverless cars for some time. This is a project that is also related to the Moore machine, because when the Moore machine had a lot of people coming in, we decided that maybe it is chance also for us to study the original classic trolley problem as well. So we opened another page and we put these classic trolley scenarios, the ones that, you know, we only put three, actually. This is, I guess, the classic, the most famous one. For those of you who don't know much, you know, this is the trolley or the box car, whatever, it's going to kill those five workers. And you're the man in blue who's standing next to the switch. You can pull the switch, it goes to the other side, kills this one person. What should that person do? And also we had, you know, because thanks to the Moore machine popularity, we also had people coming also from different places in the world. And we basically used three different versions. So the first version, you all know, the switch, we just mentioned it. Footbridge is probably the second most famous one. Again, trolley is going to kill five people. You're standing on a bridge next to you, there's a large person. You could push them now instead of putting the switch. And if you push them and they go down, I mean, it doesn't appear here in the picture. But basically, like if they fall, then they're, you know, their body is big, so it will stop the trolley, but they will die, right? So in a way, in both cases, you're sacrificing one person to save five, but somehow still people find it more acceptable to sacrifice one person in this case in this case, right? And people came up with different theories, and they, you know, there are two main differences that people have hypothesized is making difference. One of them is that in this case you're putting a switch, while in this case you're actually pushing someone, right? So there's a kind of an emotional factor, but also there's kind of like a more subtle difference is that in this case, if you put the switch, and let's say this one person actually end up running away, you'd be happy. That would be the best thing you could do, right? So it's actually, you know, it's actually nice if they end up running away, right? So in a way, their death is more like a side effect of you trying to save the 5 feet, right? While in this case, you really want the trolley to hit the person. Like if it misses them, then it's probably gonna go and kill the 5 feet. So in a way, like they call like doctrine of double effect. And some people came up with a different variation that is, where a man who's wearing knapsack and the knapsack will basically stop it. But basically, thank you for the also other reasons. So then people also came up with this middle as well dilemma where it tries to combine elements of both. So in this case, the trolley will, if you do nothing, it will continue to go and kill 5 people, just like in the other case. And if you pull the switch, then it goes into this side and then kill this one person. But unlike in the original switch, if this person runs away, then it totally will loop back into the 5 feet. So in a way similar to this one, you wanted to kind of, you know, to hit that person, right? So in a way it's similar to this one in some aspect, this one in another aspect. So, you know, as people theorize, that's actually people find it more acceptable to sacrifice one person in this one, more than in this one, and in this one, more than in this one. So that's kind of like, most of the studies that have been done before were done in mostly in the Western world. Sometimes they would include people in China or in Japan, but basically we were able to link it from about 40 countries. And interestingly, we could find that in all of the 40 countries that the order was the same, right? So in all these countries, people found it acceptable, more acceptable to, the legend is actually hidden, to sacrifice in the case of switch, then in the loop, and then in the footbridge. Now, interestingly as well, there was some kind of variation, and this variation was much bigger in case of Asia. So the second question was, like, is there any factor that we could basically help us predict why we find these differences? And one such factor is something, is kind of an index called relational mobility. And relational mobility talks about the fluidity and ease with which people can make new relationships. So some societies, it's much easier for people to make new relationships. Spaces like, you know, say London or bigger cities, and other places where maybe like in the suburb, it's much harder. So it's harder to make new relationships, but then your relationships they last longer, right? So you have this kind of more persistent relationship with people. And in the places where you have a higher relational mobility, because it's easier for you to make new relationships, you have more self-expression, you'll be more likely to find like-minded people. So you'll be less likely to hide your opinion or like this, like, you know, your social, less worried about the social signals that you send to your friends, unlike in the places where there is a low relational mobility. And there have been this paper who actually, you know, at least established this measure and talked about why they thought it came about. You know, they talked about these places that have a lot of threats, so people became more codependent, so their relationship became more like a stronger and longer relationship, and subsistence styles, you know, like growing rice also requires a lot of people working together. So anyway, it's kind of a side work, but it's for people who are interested to learn more about this. Now, why is this relevant to this story? Apparently, if you live in a place where, you know, apparently, like in moral judgment, as it seems so, like there are some moral decisions that could send a negative signal, social signal, than others. And here I'm referring to some of the work that I'm sure you know, Jim and Molly as well here, who basically, you know, showed that people, like if you do, you know, utilitarian decisions that kind of send a more negative signal than if you adopt a deontologist kind of decisions. And in a way, in these cases, you're sacrificing this one person to save the many. This is kind of a negative social signals to your friend. But if you're in a society where there's a high relational mobility, you don't care much because, you know, you can make new friends and you can meet like-minded friends as well. While in the other places, not only you would not tell people what you actually think, but you will also might even internalize the views that will not help you. So we find some kind of a strong correlation with these three different things. Of course, it is highly driven by the Asian countries, but there was a follow-up paper that did more stringent analysis on this data, and they showed that the only one that survives is this one. So in a way, it does make sense because the footbridge is really sent this as, you know, like pushing a person is quite a strong social signal. Okay, I'm going to move on to, we still have time.
About 15, yeah? 15 minutes, yeah.
Okay, so I'm going to move on to COVID relevant stuff. This is about, as you all know, of course, the last 2 years, there were some tough times, and especially there were like probably among the first cases that were in the media talking about in Lombardy in Italy, where doctors had to start making decisions about who should get the ventilators or who should be prioritized. And of course, in some countries, they have rules and they have codes. In other countries, they created committees or, you know, people or officials who made decisions were different from the doctors who were operating. And basically, people have talked about different factors. Of course, there are always the no triage cases, like first come, first serve, that people who arrive first actually should be given ventilators first. And then there's random allocation. If like a group of people come at the same time, then you should randomly allocate. And other people talk about different triage possibilities, like prognosis, who is most likely to survive, quality of life, whose quality of life is going to be better on the long run, age, giving priority to the younger over the elder, social value past, like doctors who have, maybe they became sick because they have been operating on patients, and social value for future, like students, medicine students and nursing students who are probably going to become able to help in the future. So we consider these five different and these two. So we created basically this very small survey. It was a very not at all similar to the Moran machine pictorial process, just like a, you know, quick and short questions asking people from 0 to 1 or from 0 to 100, how much do you think this factor should be considered? How much this one should be considered? And then we basically took this survey and we put it into two different places. One of them is we basically hired YouGov. As you probably know, they're kind of company, you pay them money. The good thing about them, they can get you national representative samples, quite expensive though. Because they're expensive, we could basically have to choose 4 different countries. Now, remember I told you about these 4 clusters, 3 clusters from the Moran machine. So we tried to basically choose one country from each one of those. So we had the US, we had Japan, Brazil, and France. We also put the survey on the Moran machine website. Again, we're capitalizing on this participants who are coming to the website. We put it in different places, and then people will click and take the survey. And then just to talk about this, the results, basically, if you are in favor of, let's say, prognosis, if one person thinks that prognosis should be considered, then we initially kind of basically compared it with what they thought of the first come, first served and random. If they gave a bit higher score than both, then you would say this person prefer prognosis than no triage. And the same thing with the other 4. Now we have 5 different lines. Each one of them has 2 possibilities. So we have 32 different possibilities, 2^5, 32 different possibilities. And among these 32, there are 2 extremes. One of them is full triage, when one person give a higher ranking for all of these 5 more than these other 2. And no triage, where they give all of them lower than these 2. Okay, and all of these things in between. What we find, interestingly, that in the 4 countries, that we have used national representative samples, that the strongest two opinions or the strongest two combinations were the no triage or and then full triage, right? And then whatever comes left after that is something different. Okay, so these are the four countries, and then we also had like about 20 other countries from the Moore machine. They did not have national representative samples, but we had more countries, so why not? So we can see also that these two are the strongest two, let's say, profiles in our data, in every country, let's say, right? So this is in a way kind of, and these are like the most two extreme decisions as well. So in a way, there is kind of polarization about, you know, people in those countries who some of them wants completely, you know, they would not approve of any triage possibility, others will approve of all triage possibilities, right? And we did an extra analysis to see any of the triage could be, it's like a, you know, more palatable than others, and it seems like prognosis seemed to be like the most agreeable or most acceptable among all of this. Another work with also we did is, sorry, I'm jumping now to a completely different project, but I'm not going to talk much about, but it's also inspired by the Moore machine. It's a completely different domain. It's called My Goodness, it's Charity Dilemmas. People who were in the group meeting today, I gave a full presentation for the results that we are about to submit, but basically you could either, you know, your $100 could either save Charity A, which would help 20 women in North Africa, but while in the Spiel, or you would give it to Charity B, which would help 4 women in North America. And let's say you are in North America, for example, providing them clean water, and then you would click and say, oh, I think we should do this and we should do that. And we also use literature to basically explore different factors. Again, some of these have been well studied in the literature. Finally, I'm going to talk about this paper, which is an opinion piece, but it, for me, it ties together most of the stuff that I basically presented today. You think about it as more of a research agenda that I consider. Was co-written with all these scholars around the world, and basically it's called computational ethics, and basically we're inspired by David Marr, who's you know, so kind of very respected now in the cognitive science community. Basically wrote this book about vision, and he suggested that vision should be studied at a computational algorithmic levels. And as a result of that, actually the study of vision have been revolutionized. Basically we're able today to build machines that have the human level capacity for vision. But we also became more able to understand how humans also see, right? And this was kind of like this exchange between these two things, right? Trying to put vision into algorithms made it easier to understand some of these processes. So inspired by this, we're kind of talking about that, you know, there should be some kind of a research agenda that focus on formalizing ethics. And basically in algorithmic terms, when we say algorithms, we're kind of pretty broad here, like could be anything you could think about. But basically when you know, not only formalizing ethics, but also using this formalization to either engineer ethical AI systems or try to understand human moral decisions, right? So it's kind of could be either, could serve either goal. And as I said here, algorithmic is pretty broad, could be just a set of rules, could be machine learning, could be neural networks, but could be also, you know, an equation, formal representation. And the idea here is that from one side, you know, you could use whatever we have understood about human moral decision to help us to engineer ethical AI system. But also when we go through the exercise of engineering a system, it will help us understand better our own moral decision. So it might be that those, you know, ventilators officers, maybe they were following some rules, but at the same time, there were some really specific cases where they had to basically, you know, act on their own, right? And maybe some of these cases, maybe there were some factors were not included in the rules, maybe they were not very consistent, right? So consistency is quite important here, right? Especially, so the idea of computational ethics here is like trying to make things systematic or more coherence. It's like basically there's kind of an emphasis on coherence. And of course, when we talk about coherence, when it comes to morality, reflective equilibrium comes to mind. For those of you who don't know, I suppose everyone probably know, but basically, you know, you could start usually with having moral intuition about what you should do in some specific situation. And then maybe you can go from there into building your own theory, right? And you could call that moral principles about like some kind of a general rule, like, for example, say, thou shalt not kill, right? So I can like come up with this rule that, you know, killing, you kind of hear that, you know, this person killed this person here, sounds like not a good thing to do. And then you come up with this general rule saying, well, killing is wrong, right? But then you come and you bring this theory to a test, right? Using some use cases. And now you see how would this theory work in these use cases. And then you test it out against your moral intuition, right? And then you come into cases saying like, what if I'm trying to defend myself and then I kill someone while I'm defending myself? Would killing be wrong in this case? And then you'd be like, oh, okay, so, okay, let me revise that. So then you go into another round of revising your theory, right? So until you, you know, hopefully at some point you reach some kind of coherent a rule, and basically just kind of trying to just put that into computational terms, then this would just be simply trying to use some kind of data science tools to quantify those moral intuitions and talk about formalizing those moral principles, putting them into you know, into like mathematics or into algorithmics, and then use some cases. So basically kind of the same thing, just kind of putting the computational twist to it. And basically then we could talk about, so what does it mean to formalize? So these are emerging, or let's say existing research fields that have been operating. Some of them focus on formalizing normative ethics. They use logic to formalize that, you know, deontologic rule, or use some kind of different tools to formalize descriptive ethics. I've mentioned some of two works that I've worked on that could be described in this way, formalizing descriptive ethics. Or you could have like sometimes different values. You want to balance them. So you want to build a program that can be able to balance these different rules. In terms of evaluation, you could talk about evaluating the performance of the machines and then evaluating the human ethical behavior. Again, some also, you know, you could think about research questions related to that domain. And then the idea that, you know, that evaluate is basically at this stage where you're trying to testing against your moral intuition, what does research field about formalizing the moral principles. So when you try to put theories, you're more about in this domain. When you try to test it out, you're in this way. And then, you know, if you know you have people who are working on these questions together, then you can have some kind of synergy. And then some probably new questions, or let's say more emerging fields might come out, like, for example, normative descriptive alignment, that maybe some kind of research lines will emerge to talk about how can we effectively try to maybe shrink the difference between normative and descriptive alignment, maybe whether in educating the public about the normative, or maybe in trying to understand more about what the public think, and maybe this could inform what we know about normative ethics, or human-machine emergent morality, because also there are so many situations where humans and machines will probably in the future act next to each other, and then some of these, you know, could, you know, some of these decisions could really emerge in unexpected ways. Like you could imagine that driving, let's say, next to a driverless cars, and then you might be, you know, see some kind of an intersection, and you realize those cars would have to stop anyway. So you kind of bully it. So you jump in front of it and they have to stop. And as a result, you become more aggressive in your driving. And maybe cars that are defensive will turn everyone into more aggressive driver, or maybe vice versa. Maybe maybe the cars will bully us and then we will be more defensive. And as a result, we become more cautious. So studying these questions is, you know, I guess like you could use like the game theory and algorithmic, algorithms, like some kind of domains that have been worked on similar questions, but this is just really more like a research agenda in general. And with that, I conclude.